Chapter 5 Confirmation, Schmonformation. As much as it is ingrained in our habits and conventional wisdom, confirmation can be a dangerous error. Assume I told you that I had evidence that the football player O.J. Simpson, who was accused of killing his wife in the 1990s, was not a criminal. Look, the other day I had breakfast with him, and he didn't kill anybody. I'm serious. I didn't see him kill a single person. Wouldn't that confirm his innocence? If I said such a thing, you would certainly call a shrink, an ambulance, or perhaps even the police, since you might think that I spent too much time in trading rooms or in cafes thinking about this black swan topic, and that my logic may represent such an immediate danger to society that I myself need to be locked up immediately. You'd have the same reaction if I told you that I took a nap the other day on the railroad track in New Rochelle, New York, and was not killed. Hey, look at me. I'm alive, I would say. And that's evidence that lying on train tracks is risk-free. Yet consider the example of the turkey. Someone who observed the turkey's first 1,000 days, but not the shock of the 1,001st, would tell you, and rightly so, that there is no evidence of the possibility of large events, i.e., black swans. You are likely to confuse that statement, however, particularly if you do not pay close attention, with the statement that there is evidence of no possible black swans. Even though it is in fact vast, the logical distance between the two assertions will seem very narrow in your mind, so that one can be easily substituted for the other. 10 days from now, if you manage to remember the first statement at all, you will be likely to retain the second inaccurate version, that there is proof of no black swans. I call this confusion the round-trip fallacy, since these statements aren't interchangeable. Such confusion of the two statements partakes of a trivial, very trivial, but crucial logical error. But we aren't immune to trivial logical errors, nor are professors and thinkers particularly immune to them. Complicated equations do not tend to cohabit happily with clarity of mind. Unless we concentrate very hard, we're likely to unwittingly simplify the problem because our minds routinely do so without our knowing it. It's worth a deeper examination here. Many people confuse the statement, "Almost all terrorists are Muslims," with "Almost all Muslims are terrorists." Assume that the first statement is true, that 99% of terrorists are Muslims. This would mean that only about 0.001% of Muslims are terrorists, since there are more than 1 billion Muslims and only, say, 10,000 terrorists, 1 in 100,000. So the logical mistake makes you unconsciously overestimate the odds of a randomly drawn individual Muslim person between the age of, say, 15 and 50, being a terrorist by close to 50,000 times. The reader might see in this round-trip fallacy the unfairness of stereotypes. Minorities in urban areas in the United States have suffered from the same confusion. Even if most criminals come from their ethnic subgroup, most of their ethnic subgroup aren't criminals, but they still suffer from discrimination by people who should know better. I never meant to say that the conservatives are generally stupid. I meant to say that stupid people are generally conservative, John Stuart Mill once complained. This problem is chronic. If you tell people that the key to success isn't always skills, they think that you're telling them that it is never skills, always luck. Our inferential machinery, that which we use in daily life, isn't made for a complicated environment in which a statement changes markedly when its wording is slightly modified. Consider that in a primitive environment, there's no consequential difference between the statements "most killers are wild animals" and "most wild animals are killers." There's an error here, but it's almost inconsequential. Our statistical intuitions haven't evolved for a habitat in which these subtleties can make a big difference. Zoogles are not all boogles. All zoogles are boogles. You saw a boogle. Is it a zoogle? Not necessarily, since not all boogles are zoogles. Adolescents who make a mistake in answering this kind of question on their SAT test might not make it to college. Yet another person can get very high scores on the SATs and still feel a chill of fear when someone from the wrong side of town steps into the elevator. This inability to automatically transfer knowledge and sophistication from one situation to another, or from theory to practice, is a quite disturbing attribute of human nature. Let us call it the domain specificity of our reactions. By domain specific, I mean that our reactions, our mode of thinking, our intuitions, depend on the context in which the matter is presented, what evolutionary psychologists call the domain of the object or the event. The classroom is a domain. Real life is another. We react to a piece of information not on its logical merit, but on the basis of which framework surrounds it and how it registers with our social-emotional system. Logical problems approached one way in the classroom might be treated differently in daily life. Indeed, they are treated differently in daily life. Knowledge, even when it's exact, doesn't often lead to appropriate actions because we tend to forget what we know or forget how to process it properly if we don't pay attention, even when we are experts. Statisticians, it's been shown, tend to leave their brains in the classroom and engage in the most trivial inferential errors once they're let out on the streets. In 1971, the psychologists Denny Kahneman and Amos Tversky plied professors of statistics with statistical questions not phrased as statistical questions. One was similar to the following, changing the example for clarity. Assume that you live in a town with two hospitals, one large, the other small. On a given day, 60% of those born in one of the two hospitals are boys. Which hospital is it likely to be? Many statisticians made the equivalent of the mistake, during a casual conversation, of choosing the larger hospital, when in fact, the very basis of statistics is that large samples are more stable and should fluctuate less from the long-term average. Here, 50% for each of the sexes, than smaller samples. These statisticians would have flunked their own exams. During my days as a quant, I counted hundreds of such severe inferential mistakes made by statisticians who forgot that they were statisticians. For another illustration of the way we can be ludicrously domain-specific in daily life, go to the luxury Reebok Sports Club in New York City and look at the number of people who, after riding the escalator for a couple of floors, head directly to the Stairmasters. This domain specificity of our inferences and reactions works both ways. Some problems we can understand in their applications, but not in textbooks. Others we are better at capturing in the textbook than in the practical application. People can manage to effortlessly solve a problem in a social situation, but struggle when it is presented as an abstract logical problem. We tend to use different mental machinery, so-called modules, in different situations. Our brain lacks a central, all-purpose computer that starts with logical rules and applies them equally to all possible situations. And as I've said, we can commit a logical mistake in reality, but not in the classroom. This asymmetry is best visible in cancer detection. Take doctors examining a patient for signs of cancer. Tests are typically done on patients who want to know if they are cured or if there is recurrence. In fact, recurrence is a misnomer. It simply means that the treatment did not kill all the cancerous cells. and that these undetected malignant cells have started to multiply out of control. It is not feasible, in the present state of technology, to examine every single one of the patient's cells to see if all of them are non-malignant. So the doctor takes a sample by scanning the body with as much precision as possible. Then she makes an assumption about what she did not see. I was once taken aback when a doctor told me after a routine cancer checkup, "Stop worrying, we have evidence of cure." "Why?" I asked. "There is evidence of no cancer," was the reply. "How do you know?" I asked. He replied, "The scan is negative." Yet he went around calling himself doctor. An acronym used in the medical literature is NED, which stands for No Evidence of Disease. There's no such thing as END, Evidence of No Disease. Yet my experience discussing this matter with plenty of doctors, even those who publish papers on their results, is that many slip into the round-trip fallacy during conversation. Doctors, in the midst of the scientific arrogance of the 1960s, looked down at mother's milk as something primitive, as if it could be replicated by their laboratories, not realizing that mother's milk might include useful components that could have eluded their scientific understanding. A simple confusion of absence of evidence of the benefits of mother's milk with evidence of absence of the benefits. Another case of Platonicity, as it did not make sense to breastfeed when we could simply use bottles. Many people paid the price for this naive inference. Those who were not breastfed as infants turned out to be at an increased risk of a collection of health problems, including a higher likelihood of developing certain types of cancer. There had to be in mother's milk some necessary nutrients that still elude us. Furthermore, benefits to mothers who breastfeed were also neglected, such as a reduction in the risk of breast cancer. Likewise with tonsils. The removal of tonsils may lead to a higher incidence of throat cancer, but for decades doctors never suspected that this useless tissue might actually have a use that escaped their detection. The same with the dietary fiber found in fruits and vegetables. Doctors in the 1960s found it useless because they saw no immediate evidence of its necessity, and so they created a malnourished generation. Fiber, it turns out, acts to slow down the absorption of sugars in the blood and scrapes the intestinal tract of precancerous cells. Indeed, medicine has caused plenty of damage throughout history, owing to this simple kind of inferential confusion. I'm not saying here that doctors should not have beliefs, only that some kinds of definitive, closed beliefs need to be avoided. This is what Monodotus and his school seem to be advocating with their brand of skeptical empirical medicine that avoided theorizing. Medicine has gotten better, but many kinds of knowledge have not. Evidence. By a mental mechanism I call naive empiricism, we have a natural tendency to look for instances that confirm our story and our vision of the world. These instances are always easy to find. Alas, with tools and fools, anything can be easy to find. You take past instances that corroborate your theories and you treat them as evidence. For instance, a diplomat will show you his accomplishments, not what he failed to do. Mathematicians will try to convince you that their science is useful to society by pointing out instances where it proved helpful, not those where it was a waste of time, or worse, those numerous mathematical applications that inflicted a severe cost on society owing to the highly unempirical nature of elegant mathematical theories. Even in testing a hypothesis, we tend to look for instances where the hypothesis proved true. Of course, we can easily find confirmation. All we have to do is look, or have a researcher do it for us. I can find confirmation for just about anything, the way a skilled London cabbie can find traffic to increase the fare, even on a holiday. Some people go further and give me examples of events that we have been able to foresee with some success. Indeed, there are a few, like landing a man on the moon and the economic growth of the 21st century. One can find plenty of counter-evidence to the points in this book, the best being that newspapers are excellent at predicting movie and theater schedules. Look, I predicted yesterday that the sun would rise today, and it did. Negative empiricism. The good news is that there is a way around this naive empiricism. I'm saying that a series of corroborative facts isn't necessarily evidence. Seeing white swans does not confirm the non-existence of black swans. There's an exception, however. I know what statement is wrong, but not necessarily what statement is correct. If I see a black swan, I can certify that all swans aren't white. If I see someone kill, then I can be practically certain that he's a criminal. If I don't see him kill, I can't be certain that he's innocent. The same applies to cancer detection. The finding of a single malignant tumor proves that you have cancer, but the absence of such a finding can't allow you to say with certainty that you're cancer-free. We can get closer to the truth by negative instances, not by verification. It is misleading to build a general rule from observed facts. Contrary to conventional wisdom, our body of knowledge doesn't increase from a series of confirmatory observations, like the turkeys. But there are some things I can remain skeptical about, and others I can safely consider certain. This makes the consequences of observations one-sided. It isn't much more difficult than that. This asymmetry is immensely practical. It tells us that we don't have to be complete skeptics, just semi-skeptics. The subtlety of real life over the books is that, in your decision-making, you need be interested only in one side of the story. If you seek certainty about whether the patient has cancer, not certainty about whether he's healthy, then you might be satisfied with negative inference, since it'll supply you the certainty you seek. So we can learn a lot from data, but not as much as we expect. Sometimes a lot of data can be meaningless. At other times, one single piece of information can be very meaningful. It's true that 1,000 days can't prove you right, but 1 day can prove you to be wrong. The person who promoted this idea of one-sided semi-skepticism is Sir Dr. Professor Karl Raimund Popper, who may be the only philosopher of science who is actually read and discussed by actors in the real world, though not as enthusiastically by professional philosophers. As I am writing these lines, a black-and-white picture of him is hanging on the wall of my study. It was a gift I got in Munich from the essayist Jochen Wegner, who, like me, considers Popper to be about all we've got among modern thinkers. Well, almost. He writes to us, not to other philosophers. We are the empirical decision-makers who hold that uncertainty is our discipline, and that understanding how to act under conditions of incomplete information is the highest and most urgent human pursuit. Popper generated a large-scale theory around this asymmetry, based on a technique called falsification. To falsify is to prove wrong, meant to distinguish between science and non-science. And people immediately started splitting hairs about its technicalities, even though it is not the most interesting or the most original of Popper's ideas. This idea about the asymmetry of knowledge is so liked by practitioners because it is obvious to them. It is the way they run their business. The philosopher Maudit Charles Sanders Peirce, who, like an artist, got only posthumous respect, also came up with a version of this black swan solution when Popper was wearing diapers. Some people even called it the Peirce-Popper approach. Popper's far more powerful and original idea is the open society, one that relies on skepticism as a modus operandi, refusing and resisting definitive truths. He accused Plato of closing our minds, according to the arguments I've described. But Popper's biggest idea was his insight concerning the fundamental, severe, and incurable unpredictability of the world. And that I will leave for the chapter on prediction. Neither Peirce nor Popper was the first to come up with this asymmetry. The philosopher Victor Brochard mentioned the importance of negative empiricism in 1878, as if it were a matter held by the empiricists to be the sound way to do business. Ancients understood it implicitly. Out-of-print books deliver many surprises. Of course, it isn't so easy to falsify, i.e., to state that something is wrong with full certainty. Imperfections in your testing method may yield a mistaken no. The doctor discovering cancer cells might have faulty equipment, causing optical illusions. Or he could be a bell curve-using economist disguised as a doctor. An eyewitness to a crime might be drunk. But it remains the case that you know what is wrong with a lot more confidence than you know what is right. All pieces of information aren't equal in importance. Popper introduced the mechanism of conjectures and refutations, which works as follows. You formulate a bold conjecture, and you start looking for the observation that would prove you wrong. This is the alternative to our search for confirmatory instances. If you think the task is easy, you will be disappointed. Few humans have a natural ability to do this. I confess that I'm not one of them. It doesn't come naturally to me. Counting to three. Cognitive scientists have studied our natural tendency to look only for corroboration. They call this vulnerability to the corroboration error the confirmation bias. There are some experiments showing that people focus only on the books read in Umberto Eco's library. You can test a given rule either directly, by looking at instances where it works, or indirectly, by focusing on where it does not work. As we saw earlier, disconfirming instances are far more powerful in establishing truth. Yet we tend to not be aware of this property. The first experiment I know of concerning this phenomenon was done by the psychologist P.C. Wason. He presented subjects with a three-number sequence, 2, 4, 6, and asked them to try to guess the rule generating it. Their method of guessing was to produce other three-number sequences, to which the experimenter would respond yes or no, depending on whether the new sequences were consistent with the rule. Once confident with their answers, the subjects would formulate the rule. Note the similarity of this experiment to the discussion of the way history presents itself to us. Assuming history is generated according to some logic, we see only the events, never the rules, but need to guess how it works. The correct rule was numbers in ascending order, nothing more. Very few subjects discovered it, because in order to do so, they had to offer a series in descending order that the experimenter would say no to. Wason noticed that the subjects had a rule in mind, but gave him examples aimed at confirming it instead of trying to supply series that were inconsistent with their hypothesis. Subjects tenaciously kept trying to confirm the rules that they had made up. This experiment inspired a collection of similar tests, of which another example. Subjects were asked which questions to ask to find whether a person was extroverted or not, purportedly for another type of experiment. It was established that subjects supplied mostly questions for which a yes answer would support the hypothesis. But there are exceptions. Among them figure chess grandmasters, who, it has been shown, actually do focus on where a speculative move might be weak. Rookies, by comparison, look for confirmatory instances instead of falsifying ones. but don't play chess to practice skepticism. Scientists believe that it is the search for their own weaknesses that makes them good chess players, not the practice of chess that turns them into skeptics. Similarly, the speculator George Soros, when making a financial bet, keeps looking for instances that would prove his initial theory wrong. This, perhaps, is true self-confidence, the ability to look at the world without the need to find signs that stroke one's ego. This confirmation problem pervades our modern life, since most conflicts have at their root the following mental bias. When Arabs and Israelis watch news reports, they see different stories in the same succession of events. Likewise, Democrats and Republicans look at different parts of the same data and never converge to the same opinions. Once your mind is inhabited with a certain view of the world, you'll tend to only consider instances proving you to be right. Paradoxically, the more information you have, the more justified you'll feel in your views. Sadly, the notion of corroboration is rooted in our intellectual habits and discourse. Consider this comment by the writer and critic John Updike. When Julian Jaynes speculates that until late in the second millennium BC, men had no consciousness but were automatically obeying the voices of gods, we are astounded but compelled to follow this remarkable thesis through all the corroborative evidence. Jaynes' thesis may be right, but Mr. Updike, the central problem of knowledge and the point of this chapter is that there is no such animal as corroborative evidence. Saw another red mini. The following point further illustrates the absurdity of confirmation. If you believe that witnessing an additional white swan will bring confirmation that there are no black swans, then you should also accept the statement, on purely logical grounds, that the sighting of a red Mini Cooper should confirm that there are no black swans. Why? Just consider that the statement, all swans are white, implies all non-white objects are not swans. What confirms the latter statement should confirm the former. Therefore, the sighting of a non-white object that is not a swan should bring such confirmation. This argument, known as Hempel's Raven Paradox, was rediscovered by my friend, the thinking mathematician, Bruno Dupuy, during one of our intense meditating walks in London, one of those intense walk discussions, intense to the point of our not noticing the rain. He pointed to a red mini and shouted, "Look, Nassim, look, no black swan." Not everything. We are not naive enough to believe that someone will be immortal because we have never seen him die, or that someone is innocent of murder because we have never seen him kill. The problem of naive generalization does not plague us everywhere. But such smart pockets of inductive skepticism tend to involve events that we have encountered in our own natural environment, matters from which we have learned to avoid foolish generalization. For instance, when children are presented with the picture of a single member of a group and are asked to guess the properties of other unseen members, they are capable of selecting which attributes to generalize. Show a child a photograph of someone overweight, tell her that he is a member of a tribe, and ask her to describe the rest of the population, she will, most likely, not jump to the conclusion that all the members of the tribe are weight-challenged. But she would respond differently to generalizations involving skin color. If you show her people of dark complexion and ask her to describe their co-tribesmen, she will assume that they, too, have dark skin. So it seems that we are endowed with specific and elaborate inductive instincts showing us the way. Contrary to the opinion held by the great David Hume and that of the British empiricist tradition that belief arises from custom, as they assumed that we learned generalization solely from experience and empirical observations, it was shown from studies of infant behavior that we come equipped with mental machinery that causes us to selectively generalize from experiences, i.e., to selectively acquire inductive learning in some domains but remain skeptical in others. By doing so, we are not learning from a mere 1,000 days, but benefiting, thanks to evolution, from the learning of our ancestors, which found its way into our biology. Back to Mediocristan. And we may have learned things wrong from our ancestors. I speculate here that we probably inherited the instincts adequate for survival in the East African Great Lakes region, where we presumably hail from. But these instincts are certainly not well adapted to the present, post-alphabet, intensely informational and statistically complex environment. Indeed, our environment is a bit more complex than we, and our institutions, seem to realize. How? The modern world, being Extremistan, is dominated by rare, very rare, events. It can deliver a black swan after thousands and thousands of white ones, so we need to withhold judgment for longer than we are inclined to. As I said earlier, it is impossible, biologically impossible, to run into a human several hundred miles tall, so our intuitions rule these events out. But the sales of a book, or the magnitude of social events, do not follow such strictures. It takes a lot more than 1,000 days to accept that a writer is ungifted, a market will not crash, a war will not happen, a project is hopeless, a country is our ally, a company will not go bust, a brokerage house security analyst isn't a charlatan, or a neighbor won't attack us. In the distant past, humans could make inferences far more accurately and quickly. Furthermore, the sources of black swans today have multiplied beyond measurability. Clearly, weather-related and geodesic events, such as tornadoes and earthquakes, have not changed much over the past millennium. But what have changed are the socio-economic consequences of such occurrences. Today, an earthquake or hurricane commands more and more severe economic consequences than it did in the past, because of the interlocking relationships between economic entities and the intensification of the network effects that I'll discuss in Part 3. Matters that used to have mild effects now command a high impact. Tokyo's 1923 earthquake caused a drop of about a third in Japan's GNP. Extrapolating from the tragedy of Kobe in 1994, we can easily infer that the consequences of another such earthquake in Tokyo would be far costlier than that of its predecessor. In the primitive environment, black swan events were limited to newly encountered wild animals, new enemies, and abrupt weather changes. These events were repeatable enough for us to have built an innate fear of them. This instinct to make inferences rather quickly and to tunnel, i.e., focus on a small number of sources of uncertainty or causes of known black swans, remains rather ingrained in us. This instinct, in a word, is our predicament.